the key, I think, of this summit is really to kind of establish kind of framework for the future U.S.-China relations.
China's president is coming to the United States. It's Friday, March 31st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Check us out now. Also ahead, Australia seeks to settle a complicated negotiation. Tourism is being targeted by a missile dispute. A new phone may soon be yours, and your garbage may power your life. It starts right now on VOA Asia. The much-anticipated summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping has been announced. We last spoke about potential logistics issues with VOA Mandarin correspondent Li Yuan Lu, and now we have firm details.
As I reported yesterday, actually, from the sources, that the two governments would announce this summit at the same time. So this is what they did. And it turns out that the Chinese President Xi Jinping first is going to visit Finland. So he's going to pay a state visit to Finland from April the 4th to 6th. And on the same day, he's going to arrive at Palm Beach, Florida, for the summit. So there's going to be a dinner at Mar-a-Lago. And then the next day, they're going to have more time to have discussions. And from what I know, the Chinese side is going to have a delegation. I mean, other than his inner circle advisors, you know, whenever President Xi travels, he would bring those people along with him. And also, I think there will be some business people coming together with Chinese President Xi. And I think it can be expected that maybe there will be some deals or intentions.
There are so many topics that could be on the agenda. Of course, trade and economics is probably one of the top ones because that was such a big platform of Donald Trump's campaign to reach the White House.
Trump's slogan is America First, right? He wants to buy Americans. Everything has to be geared towards creating more jobs for Americans. So I think in this side, the Chinese side can do a lot to help President Trump in terms of fulfilling his campaign promises. And I think maybe Chinese side can allow more investment into the United States, for example, to establish factories here in some of the areas where, you know, the manufacturing is actually in decline for many years. So, I mean, there are a lot of opportunities for the two countries to cooperate and, you know, strike deals.
We know you will be close by and covering this very close to the summit. In addition to all of these big issues, what are some of the things that you're going to be watching for when you look at the video and see the interactions?
I would be interested to see how the two leaders interact. We know President Obama and President Xi had this informal kind of summit in Sunnyland in 2013. We can say this is kind of a continuation of that kind of summit, like an informal summit, like the format. So I think in that kind of environment, it's less formal, less rigid, and then it also gives the two leaders more time to feel each other out and try to establish a kind of rapport, which is very important for President Trump, as we all know.
One of the perhaps most interesting summits that we will be seeing, and Li Yuan Lu will be close by watching. Thank you.
Thank you.
These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. China politics, reforms in conflict ahead of communist conclave. Gunmen assassinate prominent minority activist in Pakistan. Malaysia releases body of North Korea leader's half-brother. Myanmar's Rohingya insurgency strikes pragmatic note. First Afghan Women's Orchestra tries to change attitudes. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Australia says it is hoping to eventually ratify an extradition treaty with China after abandoning plans this week for Parliament to approve the controversial measure. Critics have insisted that China's judicial system is fraught with human rights abuses. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The centre-right government abruptly withdrew plans to ratify an extradition treaty with Beijing when ministers realised it was facing defeat in Parliament. There was dissent from the opposition Labour Party and also within government ranks by MPs worried about the lack of safeguards within the agreement to offer protection to Australians deported to China. Their concerns have echoed those of the Law Council of Australia, which said China didn't act in accordance with procedural fairness and rule of law standards in criminal proceedings. Matt Thistlethwaite, a Labour MP, says the agreement goes against key Australian principles.
Australia values democracy. We value freedom of speech. We value the right to a fair trial. We value the presumption of innocence. And we don't like the censorship of people's comments in the media.
The government insists the accord would be an important part in Canberra's law enforcement relationship with China, which is Australia's biggest trading partner. But despite opposition in Parliament, Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop says she'll continue to negotiate with MPs to ensure the extradition treaty is brought into force.
The whole idea of foreign policy is to engage with other countries on the basis of trust. And we signed an agreement with China, and there would be an expectation that having signed a treaty, we would ratify it. So that's what I'm seeking to do now, to find a way that we can honour the agreement that we made.
Australia has extradition treaties with about 40 other countries. Experts say Australia's decision to delay ratifying the extradition treaty wouldn't go down well in Beijing, but that China's displeasure would not inflict lasting damage on broader bilateral relations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Japan's ruling party said the government should consider developing the capability to strike enemy bases if the country is attacked. Lawmakers cited North Korea's missile and nuclear threats as the reason. Some are urging consideration of the U.S. THAAD missile system for defense. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Beijing's reported economic retaliation against South Korea for deploying the U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missile System, or THAAD, continues to target certain sectors like imports of Korean cosmetics, canceling K-pop concerts, and a ban on Chinese tour groups to South Korea. VOA's Brian Padden reports the sudden absence of Chinese visitors is being felt in Seoul's main tourist districts.
Smaller crowds than usual gather at Seoul's Nansam Tower to watch the daily Korean cultural performances and to look at this sprawling modern metropolis from the highest point in the city. Buses of international visitors still arrive on a daily basis, but Chinese tourists have virtually disappeared in the last month. Some tour groups and restaurants in Seoul that cater exclusively to Chinese visitors have temporarily shut down. Kim Sung-hee, a Malaysian tour guide, says this is a worrisome situation.
Well, it's comfortable for me to work as a tour guide because my guests don't need to line up and can avoid the inconvenience. It's always good to have many tourists visiting South Korea. It is sad.
China's reported tourism ban is believed to be retaliation against South Korea for deploying the U.S. THAAD missile defense system. Washington and Seoul insist THAAD is needed to defend against North Korea's increasing nuclear and missile capabilities. But Beijing views the American military buildup in Korea as a threat to its security. Beijing has not acknowledged imposing a tourist ban, but travel agencies in Seoul have been told by their partners in Beijing that tours have been canceled due to pressure from the China National Tourism Administration.
There is no document to prove this, but clearly it is understood that China is making such suggestions.
Last year, 8 million Chinese tourists visited South Korea. The sudden loss of their business has significantly hurt sales in Seoul's popular Myeongdong shopping district. Hotels and airlines have also seen declines. And there is no resolution in sight, with some travel agencies reporting no Chinese reservations for the upcoming spring holidays, which had been the busiest tourist season of the year. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Malaysia and North Korea reached an agreement to release and return the body of Kim Jong-nam, the slain half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. North Korea and Malaysia have also lifted their reciprocal travel bans that have been in place since March 7th. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, South Korean electronics giant Samsung on Wednesday unveiled two versions of its S8 smartphone in New York. It comes after last September's disastrous multi-billion dollar recall of all Galaxy Note 7 phones equipped with fire-prone batteries. The water and dust-resistant S8 comes in two sizes. Both are larger than comparable models with a curved screen called an infinity display, and they'll initially sell from between $700 to $850. The S8 features a new artificial intelligence service, Bixby, a voice command assist system that lets you use the phone as a remote control for connected home devices. And it also boosts a new facial recognition application that allows users to unlock the phone just by looking at it. The home button has been replaced with a pressure-sensitive section under the screen. New York-based technology analyst Jonathan Robini tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Samsung had two goals with the S8, to offer a phone that works and overcomes the problems caused by the Note 7, and takes smartphone technology to the new level.
With the S8 and the S8 Plus, they're starting to go into the whole ecosystem where your phone is the center of everything you do. You can connect your home devices, you can use it to shop, and you can use it to do VR and everything else. So it becomes your like main device.
How much is riding on this for Samsung, given its troubled Galaxy 7?
With the Note 7, they had a lot of issues, so this is extremely important for Samsung to get it right. They're not making any particularly innovative changes or betting on something completely new. They're just doing like a step forward into the right direction. And it's extremely important for them to get it right, but they're not risking much because they're not getting any particular new technology that has not been out there into the hands of the consumers yet.
Will this be different than Apple's offerings? Is it going to be better? Is it going to be good competition?
As of right now, what Samsung is planning to offer with this new device, we could easily say that Samsung has a better offering than what Apple is offering right now. But we just have to wait and see what will Apple do next in the next few months, if they're going to announce any new devices and if there's going to be a better ecosystem from Apple as well.
Can you describe the phone?
The phone has a curved screen, which is kind of resembles the previous S7 Edge, a slightly better version of it. Both new phones, the S8 and the S8 Plus, have this curved edge on the screen. The other big difference is that most of the real estate on the screen is used by the screen itself. So you don't have like a physical button on the screen, and the edges are fairly thin on top and the bottom of the screen. So it's a very slick looking phone, and it kind of looks more elongated than previous versions of the phone.
Of course, the battery in the Note 7 caused fires, was banned from aircraft, really hurt sales, made a big bad impression for people who are trying to buy it. How reliable is the battery in the new one?
We haven't tested it yet, but it looks promising, and I'm pretty sure Samsung isn't going to release a phone that is going to have the same issues as the Note 7. They learned their lessons, and they're going with like a safe bet. In fact, they have not increased the milliamps on the new batteries. They're actually pretty much the same as previous versions of the phones. So it seems like they're playing it safe and they're going with something that they know works and it's fairly safe. It shouldn't be exploding or giving any problems to customers.
Samsung's S8 is scheduled to go on sale April the 21st. Pre-orders are now being taken. Developing at this hour in Asia, Vietnam denounced Taiwan's military drills on and around a disputed island in the South China Sea. Hanoi called them a serious violation of its sovereignty and a threat to maritime security. Taiwan says the drills were routine. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, most of us, of course, consume energy in some form to move around, cook, heat, and cool homes, power various devices. Energy companies are continuing their search for and finding alternative and less expensive and cleaner sources of fuel. One possibility may be your garbage. Turning trash to fuel in an environmentally responsible way is a modern society's long-standing dream. VOA's George Pudich reports authorities in Tel Aviv say their new garbage processing plant is on track to produce as much as 500 tons of fuel daily.
Every day, giant mechanical claws in this new $110 million waste processing plant load about 1,500 tons of municipal trash into machines that will turn it into refuse-derived fuel, or RDF.
And this facility mainly will treat the dry materials. So half of the waste of the Dan region area will go into this facility and will be separated and will produce green energy for the cement plant.
Tel Aviv's Hiria Recycling Park consists of three plants that handle all trash brought from the city of 1.5 million people. In the first stage, advanced machines separate ferrous and non-ferrous metals, wet organic waste, and materials suitable for turning into fuel. Metals are sent for recycling. Organic waste, mainly food scraps, is turned into fertilizer, while material suitable for burning is turned into RDF, which helps power Israel's main cement factory. The finely shredded end product at this processing plant is dry and safe to handle.
As you can see here, this is the products which were separated in this RDF facility. We have plastics, we have paper, we have cardboard, we have textile. All materials are considered to be RDF, which these materials are green energy for the cement plant, replacing the petcoke, which is pollutive oil.
Annually, this plant is projected to create 160,000 tons of RDF, which will cover about 20% of the cement factory's energy requirements. About one-third of the waste, which cannot be recycled or burned, will eventually end up in a landfill. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, this is VOA News.
For nearly 20 years, Dave DeForest was a mainstay of VOA News.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting.
Dave passed away earlier in the day from a brief, aggressive, and unexpected bout with cancer. He presented the news at the top of the hour throughout his entire career at VOA. It's not an easy assignment, but Dave had a natural talent for condensing difficult, complex, and emotional stories into headlines that consistently conveyed a sense of what was happening in the world. Behind the microphone or at his desk, Dave was a quiet authority and a genuine friend to everyone he met. He was one of those people who never seemed to have missed a day of work in their life. Dave was always here, always dependable, and we will miss him always. Dave DeForest was also a bit of a history buff, so it seems appropriate to revisit a series he enjoyed doing a few years ago for this day in our history.
This is Today in History. On March 31st, 1146, Bernard of Clairvaux urged a crowd to join a second crusade against Muslim forces in the Middle East. The crowd joined the Crusader army en masse. The second crusade, though, ended in a great victory for the Muslims. In 1596, French philosopher, scientist, and mathematician René Descartes was born. Descartes is often referred to as the founder of modern philosophy and geometry. On this day in 1727, English scientist Sir Isaac Newton died. Among Newton's many accomplishments, he defined the astronomical laws of motion and universal gravitation, invented integral calculus, and developed the first reflecting telescope. In 1854, the first treaty was signed between Japan and the United States. The Treaty of Kanagawa ended Japan's two centuries of self-imposed isolation. In 1889, one of the world's most popular man-made structures, the Eiffel Tower, was inaugurated. It was built as the entrance arch for the 1889 World's Fair and named for its French architect. In 1968, at the end of a national address on U.S. involvement in the increasingly unpopular Vietnam War, President Lyndon Johnson surprised the world by announcing he would not seek re-election. On March 31, 1992, the U.S. Navy's last battleship, the Missouri, was retired. The warship, built during World War II and known as the Mighty Mo, saw action in three wars. It was the platform used to receive the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay in 1945. Today it is a floating museum at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
And today we thank you for listening to VOA Asia. We remind you that we're available in many ways. You can find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. A special shout out to our listeners in Myanmar who are listening via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thank you so much for joining us. We also would like to thank Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Carl Starling. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Anying Guo, and Michelle Cheatham. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You've been listening to VOA Asia.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his address to the recent Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson delineated the coalition's military successes against the Islamic State, including killing tens of thousands of ISIS fighters and liberating 62% of ISIS-occupied land in Iraq and 30% in Syria. He praised the efforts of coalition partners on the ground, including Turkish forces, for pushing ISIS off the Turkey-Syria border, the Libyan government-aligned fighters for routing ISIS in Sirte, the Iraqi security forces, who, with the cooperation of the Kurdish Peshmerga, are retaking the key ISIS stronghold of Mosul. He spoke of the courage of Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, noting the commitment he has shown to ensure that people are cared for after the battles, and hailing the unprecedented cooperation between the central government in Baghdad and the Kurdistan regional government as a key reason for the progress seen against ISIS. Soon, Secretary Tillerson noted, the coalition's efforts will enter a new phase, defined by transition from major military operations to stabilization. In this transition, the coalition will continue to clear landmines and return water and electricity, the basic elements that permit people to return to their homes. He added that the coalition will pursue regional diplomatic solutions for the underlying political and sectarian disputes that helped ISIS to flourish, and will continue to provide humanitarian assistance to effective communities as necessary. Secretary Tillerson noted that a successful stabilization phase will set the stage for a successful normalization phase, where local leaders and local governments will take on the process of restoring their communities with our support. The development of a rejuvenated civil society in these places will lead to the emergence of stability and peace where there once was chaos and suffering. But, Mr. Tillerson warned, none of this will happen automatically. He asked each country in the coalition to examine how it can best support these vital stabilization efforts and deal the final blow to ISIS. Finally, Mr. Tillerson emphasized that to stay ahead of a global outbreak of ISIS-related terrorism, the coalition will have to combat the terrorists' perverse ideological message, persist with in-country counterterrorism and law enforcement operations, share intelligence among nations, and break ISIS's ability to spread its message and recruit new followers online. Most of all, said Secretary of State Tillerson, now is the time to strengthen our shared commitment to security and invest in a fight in which we all have a stake.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.